Welcome, welcome, Mush Fam, to another episode of Mushroom Revival Podcast.
This is a podcast dedicated to bridging the gap between you, our lovely, fantastic, enthusiastic mushroom lovers, and the wonderful world of mushrooms. Today, we have an amazing guest. His name is Trad Cotter, and he has been one of my mentors for a while, a big inspiration, and we're super happy to bring him on the show.
Yes, indeed. Trad Cotter is a microbiologist, mycologist, and organic gardener. He's been cultivating commercially and experimentally for over 28 years, and in 1996, he founded Mushroom Mountain, where he and his team cultivate fungi for food production and explore various applications for mushrooms. He's primarily interested in low-tech and no-tech cultivation strategies so that anyone in the world can grow mushrooms, and is also the author of a fantastic book called Organic Mushroom Farming and Mycoremediation, which I've been really enjoying this past weekend to prepare for this podcast. So thanks for writing that, and thanks for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me. That book was a blur when I wrote it. It was a year late. So many ideas were coming up as I was writing it, and just really proud the way it turned out. And also thank you to Chelsea Green, the publishers. They really edited a lot of content. So there's another one in the works. We could talk about that. Yeah, just, you know, there's so much to talk about.
I hope they let you keep the mushroom psychology in that one.
Right. That was the one of the 10 chapters that got cut. I thought it was a funny one, but it was also an interesting way of trying to get people to think like a mushroom, you know, because, you know, that's how I teach cultivation and how to do research, is trying to get into the mindset of mycelium, just like you guys know.
Totally. So could you tell us, like, your mushroom story and what got you involved in fungi in the first place?
Do you want the answer I give my mom, or do you want the truth?
The truth.
So I really knew nothing about mushrooms growing up. I was mostly interested in fishing and the outdoors, and I mean, really was just walking by fungi minute after minute, second after second, and with my blinders on in the woods. And then when I was in college and I was in a band, and then I got exposed to these other fungi, you know, and someone picked a bunch of mushrooms and they're like, hey, try some of these. And I was just like, whoa, these are pretty powerful. Then I became interested in fungi. I was like, man, there's so much out there. So I started to work at a mushroom farm when I was 20 years old. And then became the head grower of that mushroom farm. And at 21, I was in charge of that farm, and I was just completely hooked on fungi. And after about a year and a half, I just decided, you know, I think that this is something I want to devote my life to. And then I had this strange moment with this older woman at a herbal conference or an herbal market. And this little lady comes walking up to my booth, and she says, you know, my great grandmother was the first female mycologist in North America. And I was like, you're kidding. And she goes, yeah, you should come by and see her house. It's like a museum. So she hands me a little piece of paper and scribbles down the address. And she goes, oh, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. And she walks away with a little cane. I mean, she's really, really old. And then she walks away. And I thought that was odd. And then I looked down at the piece of paper, and the address was like 121 Trad Street. I was like, what the hell? I mean, I got goosebumps right now. And it was weird. So I was bartending at that time, and then it was a Saturday, and I was supposed to work on a Sunday. And then I called my boss manager, and I said, I can't come in tomorrow. They're like, oh my God, you know, we need someone to come in. Why can't you come in? I said, something profound has happened. And I quit my job on the spot, just like Gary Linkoff warned, you know. He said everybody should quit their job and devote their life for mushrooms. I mean, it happened to me. That was a true story. That was 27 years ago. And after that, started Mushroom Mountain and started collecting lab gear and kept it as a hobby while I did landscape design for a while to pay the bills. And then eventually Olga and I met in Florida, and then it was just like, man, it just sparked the business, and our interest and passion and fungi just went through the roof. So from Florida, we moved here, and while we're in Florida, we set up a website, Mushroom Mountain, and we started our lab. It was a 4x6 walk-in closet, and I think that's important if you're thinking that, oh, my business is too small and I really want to grow. Well, that one day, and we had day jobs, we came home and we had one $10 order in our shopping cart, and we had day jobs, you know. So we got one $10 order, and then we went out and spent like $150 on the sushi dinner to celebrate. You know, we just went nuts. We were like, oh, this is so cool, we got one order. And then, so then we moved back here after a couple of years to the, to the hills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, where it's like the most fungal diverse in North America, and it's like a candy store here. So when we moved here, we bought 8 acres, bought a house, opened up a lab in there, the back room, which was like 8x16, which is a huge expansion. And then a couple of years ago, we found that property. Now Mushroom Mountain sits on 17 acres down the street with 50,000 square feet of warehouse space. So we went from like a 4x6 walk-in closet 13 years ago to this wonderful opportunity, this space that we really haven't even touched yet. You know, so we're occupying 8,000 square feet, and we're just kind of sitting to see what we want to do. What is the world going to do? You know, what can our business do to help the people on the planet? You know, so that's where we're sitting right now. And it all happened, I think, fairly quickly. So
are you sure that wasn't the story you tell your mom? Are you leaving out some parts?
I mean, you're leaving out the psilocybin part. I mean, that was kind of how I got introduced to fungi and mushrooms. And now it's come full circle, as you well know. And to the listeners, you know, Alex helped us set up the laboratory in Jamaica. And now we have the Blue Portal, which is a whole nother company that focuses on psilocybin production, you know, for therapy, microdosing and everything. So I'm really proud that it's come to that, and now it's not such a taboo subject. And for anyone who wants to come out of the closet and admit, hey, yeah, I've done mushrooms too, it's really not that big of a deal, you know. And honestly, more people should do it because it's non-addictive and there's all these other properties. So I've had a conversation with, you know, my parents and family, and they all just think it's, you know, what we're doing is wonderful, and to be at the right place at the right time. But mushrooms, you know, that early experience that I had when I was 19 or 20 just really, really just opened up my eyes, you know, my soul to the whole, not just the fungal kingdom, but life in general. And I think that says a lot about what mushrooms can do.
And I got introduced by your book, Organic Mushroom Farming and Micro-Remediation, which is an amazing book. Highly recommend anyone who's interested, who's new to mushrooms, who wants some practical, tactical, nitty-gritty skills on how to do pretty much anything with fungi. It's a great book. Can you talk, you know, a little one-on-one on the book, and then maybe what are you working on now on the next release?
Well, you know, I actually started writing an outline for a book when I was 22, and it was just so normal, you know. And, you know, The Mushroom Cultivator was out by Paul Stamets, and then his second one was the Growing Gourmet Medicinal Mushrooms. I just felt like it was a rehash of that. And so I wanted to do something different. And I started to think about what would it take to write a book. And I'm not really, don't consider myself a writer, or I didn't then, but now I am. And I read somewhere where someone said, if you want to write a book, write something that's interesting to you. In other words, write something that hasn't been done. So I just created a table of contents, expanded the table of contents, and there was that kind of that general mushroom cultivation guide. And so what I did was I started to create a table of contents of things that I wanted to read, that I was interested in, but I, you know, really hadn't done yet, or you know, these are things or ideas that could really help people push the science forward, or the skill and the art of mushroom cultivation. So I thought it, you know, the third of the book is cultivation. The middle third is like the buffet, you know, that's the one I really like is, hey, here's all these cool things you can do with mushrooms. It's like a, I call it a book of magic, you know, and the latter part is all research and things. And, really a book that I would hope try to inspire the next generation of mycologists and even amateur home mycologists too. Anybody who wants to grow mushrooms, you know, with this book, say, wow, you know, to someone who was reading it and said, man, mushrooms are cool. Not only can they make food and, you know, they can filter water and they can do all these really interesting things. So, you know, that was 5 years ago. And since then, I was about 50,000 words over the limit in 10 chapters. So we chopped 10 out. And so now I'm working on building on top of that. You know, like the first book could be like a prerequisite, how to grow it, how to build biomass. Very important. But the second one here is the one that I really want to be the breakthrough for me, is that, you know, there's so many different avenues in life to explore with fungi. So it explores, you know, agriculture, medicine, remediation, industry, all these cool things. So I'm taking every business or job and trying to see, where can we use fungi? How can fungi help us in each one of these, you know, industries to clean the place up, you know, and to give people jobs, all these different things. So it's a much larger book, and I hope it has the weight to really make some lasting change, you know.
And when is the tentative release date?
it was tentatively supposed to be turned in a year ago. yeah, that's a tricky subject for me and my publishers who are listening, but they keep poking me a little bit. But again, the first book was a year late, and I'm glad it was a little late because things matured, things changed, things distilled. And now there's still a lot to do with the book that I'm working on to make those chapters come true. In other words, there's that table of contents, and there's a lot of experiments to be done. There's things that I don't know about yet, so I need to mature as a person and a scientist. I need to learn more, and also I've pulled in some extra help. You know, I've pulled in two other authors to help co-write in the medical section that I felt like were my weaknesses in some of the really heavy-duty medical advice and chapters and research. So that was a big relief for me. I felt like that was a mental block, and where I could focus on the stuff that I knew or things that I could go after within a year and a half. But it's all good, and I think that it's a type of book that can be published every 4 years and have new editions, because it's also going to include case studies, and then it could be published as volumes, you know, the 2021 volume and a 2025 volume, you know, so all brand new stories, case studies, not just from myself, but as a collective community of mushroom researchers all over the world. I really want to share everyone's, you know, glory in the fungi and get everyone's name out that is working on really good stuff. So long story short, maybe within the next 2 years, and I'm hoping I get this manuscript knocked out within the next 6 months, and then it'll go into a pretty hardcore editing period. So
awesome.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, fungal innovation is just snowballing. So having another book every 4 or 5 years, I think, seems very appropriate. And you're also, aside from the wonderful literature that you're working on, you have Blue Portal, which you briefly mentioned, and I was hoping you could tell our listeners more about this project.
Yeah, so I had an opportunity to go down to Jamaica several years ago under the Farmer to Farmer program, and you went down under that umbrella, right? Did they have you down there for that?
Yeah, exactly.
And so that was a nice gig, and I'd never been to Jamaica before. I've been to Haiti. Jamaica was just a little different, and so we went down, or I went down and taught in Kingston and St. Thomas. Ended up teaching many classes. They were all sold out. They said it was like the highest attended program in the program's history anywhere. And they were swamped. And I really saw a need for the people really wanted to know about mushrooms. They saw a really good opportunity. They'd been untapped and in Jamaica, and I'm sure everywhere else in the world. And so I get there and started teaching and teaching medicinal mushrooms. And then I had some slides about psychedelics, and then, you know, just kind of moved on. And they said, no, you know, we go back to those slides. We want to know more about that. And I was like, really? And I said, well, they're illegal in the United States. And they said, well, they're legal here. And I was like, well, hold on a second. Yeah. And now we're talking. So I did some checking around, and then we went back a second time, and I met the Minister of Agriculture in Kingston and some professors at UWI, University of West Indies, and the Northern Caribbean University. And mushrooms were being sold and used on the island. And I thought that, you know, man, they're just being sold as a party drug, you know, really, to people. Why can't we try to set something up down there? So we went down, set up a lab in St. Thomas, and then stayed there for about a year. And then we decided to move the lab to Negril this past year. We had the opportunity to do some sessions there about a year ago. Yeah, last April, 2019. And just for business purposes, we decided to move the lab to Negril, which we just did this January. And we had everything lined up. We had about 2 pounds of dried psilocybin mushrooms in the freezer when the pandemic hit. So we had to move our lab or just put it in storage and get our personnel out of there 2 weeks ago to get them back to the States. So that is on hold. But I just saw some pictures of the tubs and the growing that we left down there. We had someone take care of them, and they're absolutely loaded with psilocybe cubensis. They're definitely glamour shots. And our intention is to, we have a whole waiting list of people who want to go down and get therapy guided sessions. So we have a licensed therapists and sitters who are going to go back down as soon as the smoke clears and start setting that up. So the idea is, you know, the Blue Portal for us is a brand of very well grown mushrooms, and also a connection to very, very good therapists for receiving some guided therapy sessions for different conditions. And Jamaica is just somewhere we picked first because we were there. I was comfortable with the island. We had some connections, made friends, and now we're looking at potentially going to Costa Rica in June or July. So,
very cool.
Yeah, and again, I think that not just because, I mean, as a business, you have to create income, but I also see an opportunity too on the island where there's really is a need for psychedelic assisted therapy with the people there. The culture. There's a lot of abuse, substance abuse and physical abuse, especially towards women. And there's a lot of psychological disorders that I feel like you know, that could be a nice pantry plate, the little island of Jamaica, to teach the world that this can be done if it's done a certain way. Now, there are some companies that could be taking advantage of that, and I haven't quite figured out what their motives are, but they have partnered with the government of Jamaica, and the last time I tried to call the university, they said they couldn't talk about psilocybin anymore because they signed a non-disclosure with this company who wanted to file patents and do all these different things with psilocybin in specifically. So that was a little disheartening, but I feel like, you know, we're just moving forward and going to continue to do the growing and to, you know, discover new species on the island, clone them, get them into production, and then start to work on strain development, just like they did with the ganja industry, and quantify the active components of the strains so they're more predictable with the therapy sessions, so we can use whole fruiting bodies versus synthetic psilocybin in the studies that John Hopkins and NYU and everyone's doing. And that's really what they want. I've talked to the researchers at John Hopkins, and they said, we prefer to use the fruiting body, but they have to be analyzed and it has to be, you know, quantifiable in that sense. So that's kind of what we're up to, is trying to stay ahead of the curve where we have the freedom to grow them there. We don't have to worry about the DEA busting our door down. We don't need a license. And we can also do part two, which is we could do antibiotic studies with them. We can do other things because we're allowed to have them. So I think there's a lot more medicine that whole group of fungi can create than just psychedelics. There's a lot going on with the biochemistry of every mushroom that has not been tested.
Yeah, I totally agree, and it's going to be interesting to see the wave of green rushers come in, and especially with decriminalization and legalization, what that looks like post-cannabis era, people coming in and filing patents left and right and kind of getting a little cutthroat. So we'll see, you know, strap in, and it's going to be a wild ride of a lot of great things and probably a lot of not-so-great things.
Right.
But above all, you know, I think the medicine wants to get out, and whatever happens, the benefit will outweigh any harm done. So what about your work in Haiti? Because I know you've done some work there and some other places as well.
Right. So that was in 2013. I went as a chaperone and as advisor to a group of Clemson students in the engineering department, and they wanted to bring me along with to teach mushroom cultivation and also just all there is to know about fungi. So I went to a small city called Kange, that's spelled C-A-N-G-E, if anybody's looking that up. But there's also a little village just short of that on the ride up from Port-au-Prince to the mountains. There's a place called Corporon, and that's what I call a trade school. And I heard you're real lucky to get into it. So there's not many people are accepted to that. And the students that I was with for the whole week, in the morning, I would do classroom from 9 a.m. to noon. And then we would do hands-on activities like cultivation and building a growing room and all that. That was very fulfilling. And, you know, I taught them about antibiotics. I taught them, you know, about poisonous and deadly mushrooms. And what was interesting to me the most was that Haiti is a completely mycophobic society. I mean, not mildly, severely mycophobic. And there's only one named mushroom in that country. That's it. You know, if you had a field guide in Haiti, they would say, sorry guys, this is my dogs. This is a reality show. That is just because it's funny. If anyone wants to know our dog names, that dog's name is Inoki.
Like, no way.
And she's got furry black hair and fuzzy feet. So I figured Fuzzy Foot, you know, Inoki, perfect name. And then our second dog, because we just completely ran out of names, we just called her Shroomy. So she's Shroomy. And if anybody knows, Shroomy is like an oyster mushroom. She'll eat anything. Shroomy does not have an off button. So I would, if Shroomy was reincarnated from like another organism, it's probably like a phoenix oyster mushroom or something like that. I swear she could probably eat oil and plastic.
Wow.
So, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to mention, I had a friend who named his dog Whistles and Biscuits and would just be screaming this at the top of his lungs to lure his dog back in from this giant property that he lived on in Kansas. And
Whistles and Biscuits.
Yep.
Yeah. So I had, if you bought a field guide in Haiti, it would be one page and there'd be one mushroom.
And what would that be?
That one is a Satharella. And if you're trying to spell that at home, it's Satharella. It starts with a P, Satharella. And it's a little brown, nondescript mushroom that grows on rotting logs and roots. And it's called John John, D-J-O-N, D-J-O-N. And it's sold dried, and they use it to flavor rice. And it browns the rice, it flavors it, and then they just throw the mushrooms out. Turns it brown. And it's highly prized, like really worth a lot. So they have foragers who go out and look for these little John John mushrooms. And I've had so many people contact us from Haiti, either there or here, that say, please, I want to learn how to grow these because we can make a lot of money doing it. There's a huge demand. It's seasonal because of the monsoon and, you know, season. And so if we can learn how to grow these, you know, it would be a big business. Well, that's the trick, you know. Who's growing Satharella, you know? Who's going to figure that out? So we're trying to get spores from it. We haven't been successful. There's a couple of different species. So we're really not sure what we have until we do DNA, but I really haven't been successful in getting good cultures from Haiti yet. So we're still working on that. But the craziest part is the one mushroom thing. So when I was down there and we're teaching mushroom cultivation and then we take a break and then I wander over to this like fallen mango tree and I see oyster mushrooms, like really nice ones. I'm like, wow, that's cool. So I picked them and I took them back to the Partners of Health hospital where we were all staying. And we had cooks and chefs preparing food for us and the kids at the university. And I brought the mushrooms in and they looked at them and they're like, what is that? And I said, oh, these are oyster mushrooms. These are really good. And the head cook, she could not speak English. So my interpreter told her, said, hey, listen, no, Trad knows what he's doing. I said, can you cook for these for me? And she looked at me and shook her finger and said, no way, no way. And she drug her finger across her neck like dead, you know? And I said, no, these are good. And she goes, okay. And she kind of just went, okay, I'll do it. It's like kind of like it's your funeral, you know?
Right.
So they go back, they cook them up, and then they bring them out on a big plate. And then they fried them. They looked amazing, by the way. And all the kids are in there watching me. And then I just happened to glance back over my shoulder and I looked the kitchen door, like where the kitchen was. There was five cooks and the chef. There was five heads lined up on top of each other. You know, straight vertical. They're all peering out. Watching.
Is he gonna do it? Is he really gonna eat this poisonous mushrooms?
Here he goes. I like say goodbye. And so I just kind of, they didn't see me like glance over there and I saw them. And so I started eating these oyster mushrooms and man, they were so good. But you guys, you know, my sense of humor, anybody who's seen me, I just, I couldn't help it. I mean, it was perfectly set up for me to just go, and start choking. And then I just, you know, clutched my throat so my face turned red, and I hit the ground. And they come running, screaming out of the kitchen, you know? And I looked, and one of them starts helping me up, and I just kind of stood straight up, and I smiled, and I was like, these are good. And that lady, I don't know what she said in Creole, but it probably wasn't good. Probably like son of a bitch in Creole. And then there's five of them. And I went out the first lady. I said, hey, would you like to try some of these? She goes, no. I said, second, no. Third lady, no. And I finally got to the head cook. This lady goes, you know what? I'll try them. So she tries them. And their four assistants were just like in shock, you know. And she starts eating them, and she turned, and in Creole, my interpreter said, she said that they are absolutely amazing, and she would eat these all the time. And I said, well, what does it taste like? And she goes, gosh, it tastes like meat, like chicken, and I don't know. And I was like, well, let's name it. let's name the second mushroom in Haiti. That's somewhere to start, you know, let's give it a Creole name. And, I don't know, we call it like the chicken mushroom in the village, but it's that, and we were trying to grow oyster mushrooms. So that's a marketing challenge, you know, you're trying to grow something that culture is really not accustomed and even, you know, petrified to even touch or eat. They think every mushroom is poisonous or deadly except that little brown John. So I don't think mushrooms caught on there, because the last time I heard that, you know, all the training and everything we did, you know, they just really didn't follow through with it, which I thought, if you have boots on the ground, and this is true anywhere, you really have to stick with it and show them that this works. But having a week or two here or there, in villages that are open to it, like Jamaica, that sticks, but Jamaica's not far from Haiti. And, even the Dominican Republic would be open to it, but within the borders of Haiti, they just weren't, and I don't think still are not having it, which is unfortunate, because, you know, I mean, they can make so much food from just about anything, you know, all the waste and byproducts on the island, agricultural wastes, you know, they could really take care of themselves and also share the cultures too.
So you have something called the Mushroom Mountain University, and I want you to talk about what that is.
Yeah, so after the book came out, and we were pretty busy, and then I'm on the road a lot and spent so much time on the road. So I thought, why don't, you know, first of all, I wrote the book because I was on the road a lot. And I'm thinking, maybe if I write a book, I could stay at home more. Well, that backfired, you know. then the demand for me to go speak increased. And then we decided, well, why don't we just start doing online classes? So Olga and her sister are really good at web design and programming. And so we set up Mushroom Mountain University, we started it maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And I took a break, and then we switched servers. And it's getting ready to, by the time this podcast is on, it should be back up and active again. So we're adding and shooting more videos, more content. And that's an extension of all the things that we do. And for now, it's just going to be me teaching, but I'm also inviting other researchers and speakers to record sessions and put them on there. So it's like a virtual fungal classroom. It's like pay-per-view. There's a lot of free courses that are going to be offered. And there's also going to be in-depth courses for like super affordable that they can rewatch. And there'll be classes that extend a little bit more in depth based on the chapters in my book. So there might be some new information or, you know, slides and videos and some supplemental things that can go along with each individual skill set, you know. So I feel like that's, I mean, online is going to be the future of education at some point, as much as you can. It doesn't beat hands-on and in person, but it can reach a lot of people and help a lot of people anywhere in the world. Anybody who has internet, you know?
So you're, what really, you know, fascinates me about your work and inspires me about you as a person, I think you have your hands in so many different buckets and are naturally just an unbelievably passionate and curious person. And with all the projects going on and kind of you're pretty visionary, where do you see the future of mushrooms and like what kind of science do you think needs to be executed and what science do you feel is lacking in this field?
Right. So there's so many new industries that could be created with the basic skill sets or knowledge of using fungi. In other words, you know, that's why I was writing my second book, because I felt like, man, you know, fungi can be used in a lot of different industries. So for me, you know, we do have our hands full and there's a lot of different ways to go. We try to prioritize, you know, how I spend my time, you know, so I ended up cloning myself and, you know, this is not the real trad. This is trad number three. The real trad's back at the lab. And the future of fungi to me is, I think that more people need to know how to grow mushrooms themselves, just like people plant tomatoes. You know, that's a very common thing. It's as easy as planting tomatoes or seeds in a garden. And I think if everyone starts there and gets some training wheels, then they'll be drawn deeper and try something else. But what I see more of now is a younger generation now. You know, I just turned 47, and when I was young, the only access to information I had was the Mushroom Cultivator and ads in a High Times magazine, you know? That was it. And I was so hungry for that information that I couldn't find it anywhere. So I just took it upon myself to self-teach, and things have changed. And I feel like if there's more younger versions of me, like when I was 20, there's a lot more out there now. If they have access to information and they're able to take the knowledge that we built upon and really, really expand our level of knowledge, then we've just magnified what we can do with fungi. And to me, that's the reward that I get, is meeting people and seeing people saying that mushrooms have changed their life, or my son, you know, you saved my son. He was into bad things. And I get notes written to me all the time, and I hang them up on a wall. And those are my awards, you know, that I feel like more than monetary is that, you know, medicine and agriculture, mycorrhizal research, like all these different things can wean us away from pesticides, from fertilizers. You know, you look at these industries and you try to create this mycotopian vision of what the world could be like. And for me, I just look at the world and say, you know, this is what I don't like about this particular aspect of agriculture or medicine. And those are the things that I focus on. And I try to look at things that could be, you know, game changers, and they don't all work out, you know. Don't be afraid to experiment. And that's part of experimenting is failure. And I'm very comfortable with it. I don't like it, but so the 1 or 2% of the things that really work well, you know, you just keep chasing those ideas until you start to see traction. And, you know, that's my goal and my wish for anyone learning about fungi, is to learn as much as you can, you know, read a book, you know, go on mushroom walks with other mycologists and go online, you know, get as much knowledge as you can and really go after the solutions and try to give back. You know, don't just hang on to those ideas, because your one little idea could be a really big idea, you know, a week or a year or 10 years later. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, this level of information access is unbelievable. And even still, I don't think that people realize what they can do with it, and how much information is truly out there at people's fingertips for free as well. You know, a lot of it is paid. You know, you can buy, you know, books and things like that. But a lot of it is free. And if you know how to talk to people, like, you can get papers from scientists from just writing them an email. Hey, can you send me your full paper? And they will. Or joining Facebook groups and connecting with people overseas, which I think, you know, we're pretty new to mycology in the United States, and there's a bunch of countries that are pretty new, but places like China, and a lot of Asian countries, you know, they've been doing it for thousands of years. And to tap into that network of, okay, you know, where are you guys in terms of nanotechnology, biotechnology, mycology, robotics, AI, whatever it is, like, how can we kind of tap into that with the internet? And it's huge. And these, and you're seeing kids younger and younger with access to iPhones and, or phones with internet and, or computers. So it's cool to see that access to information. It's a little scary at the same time, but, I think if we leverage it in the right way, we can really do amazing things. And one of the main things that I know you for is microremediation, and passion project for me as well. Can you talk about the Greenville microremediation project with Leif Olson, and also your collabs with Furman University and the Telluride Institute?
Sure. Yeah. So more closer to home is that, I mean, several years ago, we toured a composting facility right near Greenville. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I lecture, is I not only talk about the knowledge that I have, but I also talk about, you know, hey, you know, wherever you live, we all have problems. And if you have a problem in your community, maybe you could lead a project there. And then so my contact got handed off to this guy named Cecil Leavener, and he's in charge of composting for all of Greenville County in South Carolina, in Greenville, South Carolina. Well, they were doing curbside pickup in this city, and you've seen like bags of leaves and things like on people's curbs in urban environments, which I don't understand. People rake their yards and leaves, and they cut their grass, and they leave all this debris out at their curb. And then, you know, the city comes by and they pick it up. Well, probably most homeowners would think that, you know, that's going to a good place or composting. You know, they put it in a brown bag that's biodegradable. But in reality, those bags were being transported like an hour and a half away to one of the largest landfills in the upstate here, and to a landfill, just dumped. Biodegradable material. So Cecil got a grant and then got a site of property within Greenville. And then he contacted me and said, listen, I know this stuff is full of pollutants, whether it's pesticides or herbicides, fertilizer, things like that. So we started to test mushrooms on atrazine. And, you know, I did my EPA fellowship in Athens, Georgia, and I could either choose between silver nanoparticle research or herbicides. I chose silver nanoparticles, but I also knew from the director there that atrazine was a contaminant of interest for the EPA because it's contaminating so much water and killing a lot of different organisms. So when I came back from the EPA, this was about 6 years ago, and I met Cecil. We started to grow mushrooms on herbicides, just really like straight out of the bottle, double, triple the strength, and tried to see which mushroom strains were able to consume this herbicide. And there was no other food in the auger. No, this was non-nutritive auger with pesticides in it. That's it. And the fungi had no other option but to eat it. And we got up to 3 times the labeled rate. And we could have gone much higher, but for that experiment, we did oyster mushrooms on the labeled rate. It ate it up. Double the labeled rate, it ate it up a little bit slower. But triple the labeled rate, it just stopped and sat there and stared at me like, what is this? You know, what are you trying to do? And so we let it sit on those plates for 10 days. And at day number 12, it just clicked. Like that mycelium just took it over and started eating it like it had no other option. And that was, for me, like that epiphany that mushrooms have the keys. They can adapt and they can overcome obstacles in their environment, and they're hungry just like we are, and they don't want to go extinct. So they're going to find a way to, you know, activate silent genes, modify their biochemistry so they can produce and sweat the enzyme systems that they need to overcome their hunger, if you would, but their ability to metabolize. And after that, I mean, that was just like a catapult. I'm like, holy cow, you know, this is really interesting. And so we started to work with Furman about a year and a half ago, and that's when I met Leaf. And I already knew we had strains that were really good at eating atrazine, so we started testing other strains. And one of the low-hanging fruit that I wanted to discuss with Leaf and Furman was, well, what happens to the atrazine? You know, we could see that it's eating it, but what really does happen to it? Does it, you know, is this bioremediation, which is complete in theory, or is it biotransformation? Is it turning it into something else that we're not finding? You know, in other words, is it melting it? Is it melting down a sword and making a gun? You know, is it making it something more dangerous than we started with? So right now they're actively looking at how that works, the sequence of biotransformation of those molecules from atrazine into other molecules, because ultimately we're interested in remediation. We want to get it down to carbon dioxide and water and in other organics that are, you know, that are not a contaminant of interest, that would still, you know, make the water safe, the soil safe, whatever the mushroom's growing in. And then part three to that was, does the mushroom accumulate it? And we really don't know yet. I mean, everything looks promising, and I really can't speak to the data on this podcast. Hopefully, in 6 months from now, I think that the master's students are finishing things up. But I would hope that it would not accumulate into the tissue. That would be a very well-cited paper. And to know that mushrooms can do all this and the fruiting bodies could be safe, not just for humans, but for, you know, for birds and beetles and anything else that is being remediated out in the public, you know, with access to wildlife. You know, the last thing we want to do is to remediate a site that, say, has heavy metals or something in it, and then it produces these beautiful, juicy mushrooms that the beetles eat, and then the birds eat the beetles, and now we have, you know, hyperaccumulation up the food chain, right? So that's the kind of experiments we're doing with Furman. And the city of Greenville, they approached us through some landscape designers, friends of ours. I'll give them a plug. It's Earth Design, and I worked for them. And to have a dream team of people who are passionate about fungi is the way to go. And that's my advice to anyone wanting to remediate anything, is you can't do it by yourself. And we have architects, hydrologists, engineers, and I'm the fungal component. And we go to these meetings and we try to roundtable solve the problem. And the problem in many areas, this one specifically, is E. coli. So we're designing water filtration, low-tech water filtration technology that could be employed anywhere to help filter out and inactivate or stun and destroy E. coli and try to pull that out of the water before it gets into the watershed. And so we designed these filters made out of sand and different species of mycelium. And I mean, with everything, it's a challenge, but we have a few species of mushrooms that are front running. You know, they're just rock stars for water filtration because they can withstand the water. They can withstand the flow, the rate of flow. They're high tensile strength, you know, tolerant to salinity, like all these different things. And every mushroom is different, and every strain of every mushroom is different. And it's a challenge, and it's both promising because we can just go out and get new strains, or we could, you know, take spore prints of the ones we have and then get a different set of genetics that is capable of doing, you know, what we're asking it to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. What strains or species are you using for the filter?
Right now, we've got two or three different strains. We're using turkey tail mycelium, and we're using reishi mycelium. But the front runner right now is tiger sawgill, and that is Lentinus tigrinus, or Neolentinus tigrinus. And it's a mushroom that this particular strain my mom found, which is cool.
Nice.
Yeah, go mom. And so when I lecture, I talk about the BP oil spill, and I talk about oil spills all the time and pollution. But I also ask people if they could find salt-tolerant fungi if they're on vacation or they're at the beach to look for mushrooms along the beach. And there's mushrooms everywhere along the beach, and not many people know that. If you're looking for shells or just walk along the water, you know, divert your eyes just a little bit towards the dunes, and you'll probably find salt-tolerant fungi there. Well, about 5 years ago, my mom and dad were vacationing in Key West, Florida, and my mom was walking along the harbor there in Key West, and she found these little dried mushrooms on a Australian pine stump, which is considered an invasive in Florida, and it's a very difficult wood to break down, and it's a very hard wood. And if you tried to cut one fresh, then it would spark and probably catch on fire. That's how hard they are. And so they're very hard to degrade. So she's walking along and finds these little dried mushrooms on a stump in the lapping surf of Key West Harbor. So it had everything going for it, but I didn't know what it was. So she dried them and she mailed them to me, and they sat in my lab for like 2 months dried. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, this is right before my book came out. And so I'm like, let me just crack one of these open and see what happens. So I cloned it dried and it just took off. And so that's my preferred method of cloning now, by the way, is dried, because it works really well. But now I've got this strain with an emotional attachment to it because my mom found it. And that fungus has really high tensile strength, like really high, like 800,000 to 1 million times its own weight. It has a really diverse enzyme system. So it can eat hardwoods, conifers. It's like my dog Shroomy. It eats anything. And, you know, but the elasticity of it, the tensile strength, and then we tested it on chemicals. And it'll eat atrazine, and that was just the beginning. And then also very high in antibiotics too. So we've also screened it on my panel of bacteria that I maintain on different pathogens, gram positive and gram negative. So not only that, it could be used for a building material. Antibiotics, it's just a soup. It's got a cape on, you know. It's probably one of my favorite. And that's a testament to going out and looking around and collecting, because just around the corner, that superhero is there. It's sitting on a stump or it's sitting in the mulch, and you just walk past it. And I think they want to be found, and I think they want to help us. You know, we just got to let them help us. So, yeah, very interesting.
Super. I remember reading about one of these experiments you had going on, and it was to introduce like your own sickness to mushrooms that are growing, and then the theory is that the fungus will produce metabolites and antibiotics and such to battle with that particular whatever it was you were dealing with. Could you talk a bit more about this and any like recent updates?
Sure. We started playing around with pathogens about 6 years ago when we first moved into the big building. And a quick story, because it's funny, before we get into the pathogens, because this is kind of how it evolved. I was doing research with the EPA, and Olga was watching the lab. And then so I would be here only on the weekends, and then I would do plating. And the Petri plates, you know, sometimes you get a little contamination here and there. So I would come on a Sunday, I would check all the plates, I would zip up the contaminated ones and I'd throw them in the trash. And then I'd go back to Athens, Georgia for a week. I'd come back Friday. And man, that Ziploc was still sitting in the lab trash. So I looked at it and I noticed this fungus is trying to kill the other one. And it's totally sweating metabolites all over it. And so I started watching those plates, and then I started to set up galleries purposefully. You know, I called them gladiator matches. And then I set those fungi against fungi for a while. And then we moved into our new lab, and Olga asked me, she goes, well, what do you want? It was right around January, February. We just moved in, and my birthday's in January. So she goes, what do you want for your birthday? I said, I don't want anything. And she goes, well, just buy what you want and I'll wrap it up. I said, okay.
Uh-oh.
There we go.
That's dangerous.
I said, okay. And so I went on a, we're a registered level 2 lab. So, level 2, you know, level 1 is general biosafety. Level 2 is you can start working with pathogens that aren't airborne if you're safe. And then, so I got on there and I ordered E. coli, staph, strep throat cultures, pneumonial cultures, salmonella. That was on my wish list for my birthday. And candida and pseudomonas. And it wasn't a random, this is what I want, but there are gram positives, gram negatives in there. And so I got those. And they were delivered to the house, and there was a big biohazard sticker on there, you know, and I was like, what the hell is this? And I'm like, it's my birthday, you know? And she goes, well, I'm not opening it here. I go, you're damn right. I was like, you know, so I took it to the lab and I started playing around. And then we that was one of the chapters of the book, the initial, there's a couple of pages in there that talk about when we first started doing that. So we created these little modules that you could inject a pathogen into, because we saw it on a plate. We saw little droplets. And to me, that I was like, that's great. But it wasn't enough. I mean, we really needed volume. So we created these 5-pound bags, and then we injected the pathogen into these little ports. And then we get a metabolite, and then we mix the metabolite back into plates, and then we get complete inhibition of that pathogen. You know, we worked with E. coli a lot. And so then I started playing with the design a little bit, and we're still, I think we're about done with the design. In fact, I was just making more yesterday, and we partnered with Clemson University here to run a test with drug-resistant bacteria, mainly MRSA, and I want to think it's vancomycin, VRC, vancomycin-resistant E. coli. And so we tested a few different fungi, turkey tail, shiitake, and some others. But what on the tail end of that investigation, what we found were some late submissions were showing really strong activity against MRSA. And those fungi were chicken of the woods and jack-o'-lantern. which is, I mean, chicken of the woods hyperaccumulates sulfur. That's what, you know, sulfurous. If anybody who's ever cultured it, you know, when you got chicken of the woods sawdust spawn open in the lab, it smells bad. It smells like sulfur. And most sulfur-based drugs that are using for staph infection, or they're sulfur-based, just like that. So was this fungus showing us potentially that it was capable of also sweating out metabolites on the plates, which chicken of the woods doesn't do that. A lot of mushroom cultures do it in sterile culture. They'll sweat normally. But this particular strain was something we isolated down near the coast, and it was a chicken of the woods strain, and it produced a lot of metabolites. And so we tested it against MRSA, and not only was it showing inhibition, but it was also predatory, which I found that fascinating too, that it was most inhibition studies, you'll see that the fungus kind of stays away from the bacteria, and then it'll diffuse molecules into the auger and kill or limit the cell production of that bacterium. But this one was actually aggressive and actually climbed over the top of the MRSA colony and just started carpet bombing it, you know? And I'm just like, you know, this is Shroom TV, you know? I'm like, who needs cable, right? So then we tried a jack-o'-lantern mushroom.
Will this be a channel on your Mushroom Mountain University?
A Shroom TV? I don't know. You should type in shroomtv.com and see where it goes.
Do you have that website?
Of course we do. When Olga and I were in that apartment in Florida, we registered shroomtv.com 13 years ago. So you could call that saving it for a rainy day.
There you go.
And the jack-o'-lantern, which is a poisonous mushroom, is actually more aggressive and easier to grow than the chicken of the woods was. And then we found another one called the orange mock oyster, which also was active against staph. Now, anyone who's listening, does anybody know what the common connection is between chicken of the woods, jack-o'-lantern, and orange mock oyster?
They're all orange.
They're all orange. And they all produce sulfur-based compounds in their mycelium. So I thought that was very interesting. Wow. So we started cultivating jack-o'-lanterns commercially here. I don't know if anybody else has tried it.
Do they glow? And when you cultivate them, do they still have that glow?
They still have the glow, but it has to be late stage. And I remember having these growing in our lab and in our fruiting room. And whenever we have a speaker coming to town, you know, I'll let Gary Linkoff, you know, stay with us several times, Tom Bolk, and, you know, people just come in and stay at our house. And then I'll give them a tour of Mushroom Mountain. And then I'll give them the VIP tour. So they put on booties and come in the lab because they know what they're looking at. You know, I know that I trust them in the lab. And I remember a couple researchers were just looking on my bags and they're like, what the hell are you doing with that? You know, I was just like, you know, well, jack-o'-lantern, really good staff and, you know, MRSA studies. And then they're like, but why devil's urn? You know, why are you growing devil's urns? I said, because every fungus has a gift. It has something going on. And, you know, so from that moment, I think a couple years ago, when I first started playing around with the bacteria, then it really set me off on a challenge to try to create something that was more hospital friendly. So we redesigned the bags for Clemson with a few more bells and whistles to make them easier to use in a clinical setting. So they wouldn't like mix or spill, if that makes sense, you know? So you have a pathogen and then you have a metabolite. Well, you have to design it so you're not pulling out a pathogen, you know, out of the metabolite port. So Those were 5-pound bags that got shrunk into 2-pound bags more efficiently. And now our latest design is about the size of a 50 milliliter test tube. And it's actually more efficient than the 5-pound bag, which is great.
Wow.
So we've managed to miniaturize it. But more importantly, not just miniaturization of that, is that these particular devices can be used in an automated system that already exists, which is a robotic system. Meaning, if you could go into a hospital or get an infection, you know, the virus is hot topic right now. What if, you know, that flesh-eating bacteria or virus, you could take a sample from that patient, and then the doctor takes the swab, the robot injects it into that particular barcoded device, and then within 24 to 48 hours at the most, that was the coolest thing, is the reaction time with the fungus. When you pair it with some with a specific solution, and I can't tell you what it is, that amplifies the pathogen to where the fungus responds by creating a very large volume of metabolite very quickly, that would be patient specific and pathogen specific. So those are the things that keep me up at night. It's like, that's the most important thing to me right now. You know, the Blue Portal is awesome. You know, that's great. But in this day and age, you know, we're bacteria and viruses and all that thing. These things are mutating so quickly. I think a patient-specific approach is maybe a more intelligent medical or design for our society, you know, for the world, is that, you know, just taking broad spectrum antibiotics is what got us here in these predicaments. So just looking for another angle. And I hope that the new designs look very promising. And we've been getting contacted in the last few weeks about putting our device to trial. So that's
for COVID.
Right. Yeah. So,
wow.
Just yesterday, you know, so it's, I don't know when this will air, but that was early April, 2020. Yeah. So I've been talking to some folks, at the CDC and NIH, and seeing what they're up to and see if they're willing to give it a chance. You know, it wouldn't take much. So I've already started creating some of these devices in our lab in hopes and anticipation that we would get a green light to do something, or funding to do it, at least to be supplier to do a trial. Because this thing's not, you know, pandemics don't go away. Flesh-eating and drug-resistant bacteria are here forever. I mean, this is just the state of what we got to deal with. So I feel like if we can help contribute to that science and do something that could be a game changer, that's what I like to do. You know, that's what I like to work on. And
next is COVID 2021, you know.
Yeah.
They're here. They're always we're always gonna find new species in some cave somewhere that's never been discovered, and they're gonna mix with humans, and there's gonna be a new virus. It's never going to go away. And we're really, I think what we're seeing is we're vastly unprepared.
Yeah. And vaccines take way too long. Like
way too long. So to have something in 24 to 48 hours is huge. And I think you said as well that it can be diluted as well to up to 500 gallons and still be effective. Is that true?
Yeah. I was getting ready to get to that. That was the startling thing, was that, the bags would produce about 20 milliliters of solution, and that was active like 10 to the 6. So yeah, you could make like over 528 gallons of active ingredient. So you wouldn't need that much for a patient. So even if we just get a couple milliliters in each tube, that could potentially be used, and or, you know, the system would be set up where, you know, you could inject a bacteria or virus into these modules. We haven't tested it on any viruses yet, but I think it would be worthy of doing a trial to see how mushrooms create novel antivirals, you know, and if that a couple modules can create enough of an antigen or something, a protection against this virus for a single hospital, you know, that's a big deal. And to be able to do that quickly would be a dream come true. So again, I think that, you know, you asked me what I like to do and what I'm into. And I just think that I want the world to be like that, you know, whether I come up with it or you come up with it or somebody comes up with it. I just feel like somebody's got to do it. But there's a lot of different ideas out there. And to me, it's stimulating just to work on it. Mm-hmm. And so far, we've seen it work with bacteria very well. And I just, like I said, every day I wake up and wondering what are mushrooms going to do today? You know, it's just like, what are they going to teach me? It's just like watching, turning on a show and saying, here's Shroom TV. You know, what are the Mushroom Kingdoms got on today?
And it's infinite, truly. And the two topics that I'm the most fascinated with, really like putting my geek hat on, is secondary metabolites, which, you know, not only antibiotics or these helpful solutions for so many problems in the medical field, but it kind of weaves into my second passion, which is kind of messing with insects. And I wanted to go into your research on insecticides. And you have some really funny stories with also, I think it was your Christmas present that you bought yourself, the flies, I think it was.
Right. So, yeah. So these are jokes that just can't be written. And I tell these on tours, and because people think it's just like insane. Like, why would he order? So I tell, and so for birthday, I got E. coli, salmonella, you know, all these different things. And then, so I start talking about entomopathogenic fungi, right? So these are fungi that can infect and mummify and kill insects. And we started by finding our first one, which was a very large carpenter ant in the upstate South Carolina. And I haven't found many of those. I mean, in the past few years, in the last 6 years, I've maybe found five of them. It's a very rare fungus. And so we sent the ant to Harvard, and the researcher, Dr. David Hughes, who's now at Penn State, anyone listening, I'll look his webpage up. He's nuts. And if he's listening, man, I love you. you're nuts in a very good way. And he does the behavior manipulation of aspect of the whole process, which I think is fascinating.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And he was a biological consultant for the movie World War Z, which was about zombies. And he called me up and said, where did you find this thing? And I said, I found it down in South Carolina. And he goes, man, he goes, we haven't seen this fungus on that ant in literature or anywhere since 1907. And, wow. And so we cloned it and then started using it against fire ants and things like that around here. So I was out in the yard one day, and I said, I just had this great, like, it was like what I would call a two beer idea. Right. I said, hey, Olga, what do you think? I'm going to make fire ant farms in the house. And she's like, what? I'm like, yeah, good idea. And, he's like, I don't know about that. And I said, well, they're not going to get out. I said, okay. So we dosed the ants, fire ants, with this fungus. And yeah, I did some research and noticed it was closely related to Camponotus, you know, the Solenopsis and all that. Well, I ended up mummifying the damn fire ants. And I was like, shit, that's cool.
Wow.
That's a big deal down here in the South. You guys don't have fire ants up there in Boston, yeah? No?
No, not too many.
That's all right. I'll send you some. I'll pack up a whole mound.
Cool. A little module kit, a little fire ant farm.
When's your birthday?
So, it just happened. Yeah, you got to send me the fungus too so we can inoculate.
Okay. So then we started doing mound treatments here, and then we started figuring out, well, we're getting some really good mortality rates, but it wasn't consistent. And that's where Clemson helped us out, is that they had some fire ant research, and they gave us a whole, like, flash drives full. It was like a treasure trove full of research and ways to do things. So we started digging up queens and putting them in, like, making artificial chambers and things for queens and workers. So we were rearing last year. We're literally rearing fire ants in our lab and dosing them and getting them to mummify and doing a field trial. And what's interesting is that those ants, they feed at carbohydrates above one temperature and, or excuse me, proteins above a certain temperature and carbohydrates below that same temperature. And it flips like a switch. So we modified, like, the carrier and got really good mortality in the last 2 years. So that's a very promising field study that we did. Then we started finding...
Guess what's actually a couple inches from my computer right now?
A cordyceps.
Exactly. The one you gave me a couple years ago at New York, the one growing on an ant.
Oh, sweet. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're fun. And there's so many. And since we found one, which was really cool, it goes back to, like, just walking past mushrooms when I started, you know, when I was young. Now it's like I can't stop looking at branches and for cordyceps, because they're there and we're walking. They're so small and they're very easy to miss. And those are a lot of fun because they're so dramatic. You know, you see this insect and you see mushrooms popping out of its brain and all over its body. And you're like, damn, you know, bad hair day. You know, it's like, what a way to go. And so we just start collecting them. And when I lecture, I show pictures of them. And, you know, even to kids, you know, I do children's programs. You know, I'm like, shit, this is what's going to happen if you don't clean your room, you know? And they're like, oh. And, you know, I got to have fun with the kids. Sure. So we started finding a lot of other species and strains, and cockroaches, spiders, wasps, like beetles. We found one beetle. We were testing it against a Japanese beetle for a little while, and we just didn't have time to pursue that one. But we still have the fungi. I'll get to the fungus gnat story in a minute. Don't worry.
Is that from Telluride?
The beetle? No.
Yeah. No.
No. We found a grasshopper over there. But so, yeah. And then so I got the bacteria for my birthday. So Christmas comes around the following year, and then always like, well, what do you want for Christmas? And I was like, I don't want anything. You know, I don't like even giving, gifting or receiving. It's like, it's a weird holiday for me. So I'm just like, I don't want anything. I'm good. And she goes, well, just get yourself something and I'll wrap it for you. I was like, okay, here we go again. You know? And so I got online and I found a biological supplier selling virgin female fruit flies. I know what you're thinking. Yeah, can't get that at Walmart. So I looked at them, and the reason I was looking at it was because there was a researcher. I spoke at the Penn State short course like two seasons in a row. It's every other year. And I sat through a pesticide talk, but this guy was older guy, genius. He was talking about how they used pheromones, and he tested pheromones as attractants. I thought, man, this is cool. It's different than somebody just giving pesticide credits away, you know, like, all right, this is up my alley. So then he starts talking about virgin female flies and if they have not mated, that they can attract a male from like 100 feet away in a space, alive or dead. That was what it was crazy. He did it with living ones and living virgin female fruit flies. So, and he even showed video of it. And I thought about that for a while, and then I came back and then, you know, bought my Christmas present, which was 100 female virgin fruit flies. And I'm like, let me just play around with them. But my first idea was, you know, we found a fungus that mummifies fungus gnats. And my first notion was to let's train these, you know, what if I dust the females with this entomopathogenic fungus, right? You just dust them, powder them up, and then you release them like into the fruiting room. Yeah. It sounds horrible. And this is the dark side of trad, by the way. And so essentially what my idea was, hey, we'll just weaponize the females, because every male is going to try to mate with these 100. So they're all going to get contact time, right? And I was teaching at Clemson and to a group of 500 students. And there was this student who was sitting down front. Here's my dog parading in. And this guy was sitting down front. Oh, it's like, this is reality TV. And this male student was like, I was talking about virgin flies and dusting the females and releasing them into a space. And this male student says, what does that mean? And so I was trying to put it into a perspective of like what this young male student could grasp. You know, it's just like he woke up into my conversation. And I was like, okay, imagine you're at the club. Right. And you walk in and all the girls have Ebola, but you don't know it.
Oh my God.
And in front of this kid, a look of horror, he was like, man, that's not cool. You know, I was like, you damn right it's not cool. And I said, we basically were weaponizing the females. And I mean, just the look of horror. But to me, like, I weaponized them and then I didn't release them in time. So I went out of town. I came back and like two were dead. And I found out that the fungus I was using wasn't highly active against those, the fungus gnats. It was a commercial product called Botanigard. You ever heard of that? Mycotrol.
Is that Isaya arenosa?
No, it's Bavaria, Bassiana. Oh, cool. It's that one. But it's listed for fungus gnats. Well, the truth of it is, it isn't that active against it. But what happened was two out of the 100 died. So I played it out the two, and I captured a whole bunch of fungus gnats with a little vacuum device. So I had all these dead fungus gnats in this bag, and I poured them into a agar gel, so they're like all suspended, you know, in the gel. Look like something from Silence of the Lambs or
totally.
Dexter, whatever you call it. I don't know. But so I've got like these gel plates just full of like fungus gnat bodies, and I streak the two females across the plates, and then it just starts eating them. So what we're trying to do is create cuticle recognition, right? So whatever strain that killed those two out of 100, we would carry those genetics forward. So then we isolated those. And then I've caught more fungus gnats, sprayed them, and mummified. And then we were getting like 90 to 95% mortality, which is great. So
wow. With one like generation.
It was three generations. And
well done.
Yeah. And so this leads into a whole cool conversation that affects your area. Okay. Have you heard of the spotted lanternfly?
No.
Sounds familiar.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So anyone in the northeastern U.S. should look up spotted lanternfly, as this will affect you. It will be affecting you if you don't follow my directions. All right. There's a good biological threat. So spotted lanternfly came from China. It prefers to eat the tree of heaven. So it got into Burke, Pennsylvania, and just started eating up all those trees. And everybody's thinking, this is great. It's like an invasive tree. We don't want it. It's just going to eat those. Guess what? It got hungry and started eating a lot of other stuff. So it went after the native grapes. And then when the native grapes were gone in a particular area, they turned their eyes on the vineyards. So in eastern Pennsylvania, if you look at spotted lanternfly damage, you could probably pull it up on your phone and see it. It's nuts. It looks like an entire vineyard got doused with gasoline and set on fire, like torched. And it'll do that quickly, really quickly. And it is now spread to New York, Maryland, and West Virginia. And it's a beautiful moth-looking, it's a leaf hopper, so it's a sap sucker, but it absolutely covers the host plant and just drains it and just kills it. And I didn't know about it till about a year ago. And then I was lecturing at a Mother Earth Fair in Pennsylvania and was showing pictures of mummified insects. And I said, you know, my usual, well, hey, you know, if you ever have a problem with an insect in your particular area, you can find it, you can mail it to me. So this lady emails me some pictures of these bugs from Pennsylvania. And she says, I need to get these to you. And I said, what are they? And she goes, spotted lanternfly. And I said, I have no idea what that is. And I looked it up, and it's the number one, the USDA is calling it the number one, the number one threat to agriculture since like 1910. It's really bad.
Oh my God.
It's terrible. So she found 100 fully mummified spotted lanternflies covered with an entomopathogenic fungus. I was like, holy cow. And I said, well, if you want, you can mail them to me. And I actually had her sign a chain of custody letter. So she knew that I wasn't going to take her bugs and like sell the fungus and make millions. You know what I mean? So I had her sign off on it. So she would be included with any plans for this thing that we have. And I said, well, can you mail them down here? And she goes, the hell with that. I'm going to drive them down. So she drove down from Pennsylvania, hand delivered the lantern flies, and we were able to culture it out and maintain it. So we've been maintaining it for about a year. All right. It's highly virulent against that particular pest, which is really good. And so we're hoping this year with our Mushroom Mountain University that we're going to put up a class on how to identify mummified insects and also how to create your own mycopesticide using standard kitchen equipment. So anyone can find these or even find them and share them as a community to help put that fire out, because it's on fire. That thing is going to spread until something stops it. And right now the only course of action would be spraying. So a lot of the pesticide companies are getting special permits to spray really nasty chemicals, and they're charging like $200 a tree to spray.
Wow.
$200 a tree. And these pesticides are not racist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They kill everything. And they are going to kill all the beneficials and the whole immune system of wherever they're controlling. The chemicals are very nasty. So my hope is that, you know, we have, and we've amplified this fungus. We've got bags and bags and bags of it, tons of it. But here's the problem. I can't sell it, right? I cannot sell it. So I think what our plan is to bring it back and do workshops. And maybe you could help me and me and William or somebody, whoever's in the area, and teach people how to make this pesticide in their house and just give it away. Because that was from Burke County, Pennsylvania. That should, the way the EPA loophole reads is if you find it there in the state, you can use it there. And I believe that that's how you conquer it as a community, you know, knowledge and sharing that particular culture. Otherwise, now we're back to a chemical lifestyle, which doesn't work. So
yeah, and I want to demonstrate how easy this is for the listeners. I mean, I remember a few years back at Telluride, you had a last minute kind of overlap with your teaching, and you ran into me on your way over. You said, "Hey, you want to teach the second half of this entomopathogenic fungi insecticide class really quick? It's happening in 2 minutes." And we were like, I'm like, okay, what do you want me to cover? And you go, tell the recipe and how people can find their own and make their own. And here it is, listed it off. And I was like, cool. And you're like, maybe to save time, you can go out for a foray and try to find one. And you're like, good luck. And that was, you know, I'm always cordyceps crazy, but people at Telluride were like, oh, good luck. You're never going to find anything, or, you know, if you do, it's pretty rare. And I was like, no, I can, you know, like I have faith, I can find them. And we taught that little section and just walk outside, and we crossed the street, and the first tree we looked at turned over the first leaf, and there it is. It was a mummified insect. And then awesome. All the people in the class were like, wait, is this one? Is this one? And so it's so easy. And the thing is, you know, everyone can find mummified insects anywhere. And every time I teach, I say the same thing. It's like people always look at the ground for these mushrooms, you know, for chanterelles, for morels, for boletes, whatever. But they don't look like under leaves. You know, you would never in a million years look under a leaf to look for fungi. Mm-hmm. Other, you know, and except if you were looking for entomopathogenic fungi, or just like they're like finding a golden snitch in Quidditch, or like it makes the mushroom hunting experience so much richer because they're so hard to find. But once you find the first one, they're everywhere.
Yeah, and I'll give a shout out to Todd Elliott, who taught me how to grow hunt cordyceps, and he's now getting his PhD over in Australia, and he was writing papers at like 13 or 14 years old, and I met him at a foray, and he was 20 years old, and I'm leading the foray, and I tell everybody to go in the woods and meet back in an hour and a half, and then Todd's just sitting there looking at me and just staring at me, and I'm like, where are you going? He goes, well, which way are you going? I'm like, I'm going whichever way you're going. You know, and then so it was just kind of a standoff. And then he goes, okay, I'll go first. You know, and then so he storms off, and I follow him, and he finds cordyceps mushrooms in about 60 seconds. And he's known for that. So that's why I wanted to follow him. And then he proceeded to teach me like some tricks, which the listeners can, you know, like you said, under the leaves. He goes, listen, man. He goes, this is how I find it. He goes, get under these beech leaves on a sunny day, and you look up, and you'll see spots on the leaves. You know, so you see the outline of the insects potentially. So he got up underneath these beech trees, and sure enough, you could see little bumps or spots. We pulled the branches down, and there'd be mummified insects on them. Oh, yeah. I go, damn. And since then, we have cordyceps infected ants all behind our woods here. It's just the coolest thing behind our house. They're everywhere. They're ones that are up in the trees. And They're hard to spot during the day, but one night I went out because I needed some for teaching, and it was at night, so I went out with a headlamp, and I found more cordyceps more quickly at night than I could in the day, because I would take my headlamp off and just shine it along branches, and you wouldn't have all that background noise, you know, the forest, to challenge your eyes against, and you would just have this focus, and then you would see these cordyceps just hanging out in the branches like at night, and they were everywhere, and they were so easy to find at night, and that's the disease, you know, that we have, is that once you start studying mushrooms, like, you know, your way of life is over. You know?
Yeah, it leads to a midnight zombie fungus hunting.
I tell you. And what else would you rather do? You know, watch the news?
Nothing. Like, no, no. That's I want to do that tonight.
No, Shroom TV. That's what's on.
Yeah, so it's exciting that, you know, like I said, that one find, we found one cordyceps, you know, several years ago. And now it's completely just, you know, kind of taken over a part of our life here. And we've tried to advance and create and spread knowledge and awareness of it. And it only took one find, one little thing in the woods to spark that, that springboard, you know, and it, for me, it's like that all the time, you know, just, mushrooms show you what they can do. And you're like, oh, what can I do with that? What can we do with this? But, you know, I always tell people on the tours, we really are a company that makes things that people need and not what they want. And there's a big difference there. You know, there's a lot of people and companies making things that are just ridiculous. You know, fidget spinners. Great. You know, planet's got to have them. Got to have them. Right. No. Let's make things that create change our medical system or clean up agriculture or create novel building materials. You know, those are things worth the effort, you know, and I think more people should be working on stuff like that.
So. Yeah. And in your book, you have a lot of innovation in there. You had a whole section on like little arts and crafts almost that you were doing with fungi. And there's one thing in particular I wanted to ask you. And it was when you wrote about using spore ink. There's a picture of this spore ink that you made in front of a printed document. Mm-hmm. And the caption of the picture was spore ink can literally make paper come to life or something. Did you put this ink into a printer and then print with it?
We did. You know how you have those little drill kits that you can refill inkjets with? You ever seen mm-hmm. those? Yeah, you can refill them. You can actually fill them up. But the problem is that printer ink, you'd have to use it like right away because the spores will germinate and it gets a mess inside. So if you're doing a printing, you could do it right away. Now, the other issue is that the... it has to evaporate really quickly. So toner cartridges, you know, they're wet and they have compounds in there that evaporate really quickly. So it dries. And a lot of those are volatile to spores. In other words, it would destroy them. But if you do it at a low concentration and can tolerate a page coming out and waiting 60 seconds to dry, it'll work. And we've got some pictures of spores germinating on paper, which is really cool. These little germ tubes coming out.
I would love those.
I'll send you a picture of that. And also, you know, we've got designs and box designs that we were going to use for our sport ink, and we have a logo done, and we just got busy doing other things. But the idea was there, and that was the book. That was the purpose of doing that for the book. We didn't patent it. We didn't do anything like that. There's tons of ideas in there that I wanted people to say, hey, here, this is a cool idea. Run with it, or maybe somebody can use it, or maybe we should be doing this. You know, it was just like that. It's like more open source, you know, getting people to think about it and building off of maybe that particular idea. Like that one cordyceps in the woods just sparked, you know, made me into a cordyceps maniac. You know, maybe this ink thing would cause an engineer or a young student to go in a different direction, you know, and create something novel. So,
yeah. What species did you use?
It was the darker spore one because the black ink is used the most. So we were using Hypholoma. Even I think one of the pictures it shows Caprinus in the book. That's not that was that one didn't work out too well. But we've been using Hypholoma spores, specifically like Subladoridium, which is a brick top or darker. They're not pitch black, they're more of a brownish black. But Stropharia works really well. King Stropharia are very dark, very black.
Cool.
So I asked my publisher, I said, maybe in the next time they print my book, we could dose the ink with the spores. And then if somebody's book gets wet, it would be like a pop-up book. You know, they could turn it to like page 80 and then just like oyster mushrooms would come popping up out of it, out of the middle. That'd be fun.
It'd be super fun.
I mean, there's a million. We're like running out of time, and we could go on for the next five hours with all the amazing things that fungi could do, from antimicrobial cutting boards to mushroom beer, which I'm super excited to try at Telluride again. I loved your lion's mane pale ale to regrow the neurons while you're killing them.
Yeah, I should call that one plus two minus one. That'd be fun.
Is there anything that you wanted to touch on to tell our listeners, and any niche in the wonderful world of fungi that we miss?
I don't know. Again, there's so much to talk about. I may speak to more about what's in the news now, and I feel like with the coronavirus out, that more people are paying attention to nature and nature-based solutions, and everyone is at home. They're thinking about growing their own food. They're recycling. You know, they're worried about running out of supplies and things like that. And my only request would be, when this thing goes away, we should just keep that idea. You know, we shouldn't go back to where we were before. You know, this has to be a wake up call and say, hey, you know, we should learn more about grow our own food, growing our own mushrooms, or, you know, recycling more and all these different things. So, you know, I've had some long conversations with people calling me at the farm. And I feel like it's such a terrible, like when you have a pandemic, but at the same time, it's a wake up call. You know, we have this ability to say, we can't keep going on like this. The world is suffering, and now it's, you know, now it's our time. We're suffering. But if we change, if we can make some drastic changes, is what I'm asking for, not incremental. It's too late for that. You know, the car, we have to turn this thing around, and mushrooms is definitely one of them. It's one of those things that if you just grow a few mushrooms at home, or if you have a young student or child, and you know, they liked my book, and Alex wrote a book too, you know, and they start learning how to remediate things, and this is our future. And now is the time to fix it, right? That is it.
So that's a perfect segue to the last question that we ask every single guest on our show. Uh-oh. If mushrooms had the microphone and could say one thing to the whole human race, what would they say?
One word or one thing?
One thing. It could be a couple sentences.
Ask not what mushrooms can do for you, but what you can do for your mushrooms.
That's a good one.
Love it.
I'll vote mushrooms for president in 2020. The polypore party is strong.
And so, you know, again, everyone, I highly recommend checking out Trad's book, Organic Mushroom Farming and Micro-Remediation. Mm-hmm. Also going to Mushroom Mountain, Shroom TV. Where else can people find your work?
Shroom TV. It's Mushroom Mountain. We have a Facebook page. I think it's Mushroom Mountain Farm. I'm not on there that much. I'm not on social media that much, but check it out and be active on there. You know, grow something, post it, go out mushroom hunting, just enjoy it. And most of all, you know, if you're not having fun, you know, that's the whole purpose. Is a lot of good things happen when you surround yourself with fungi. So just go out and, you know, get involved. And, you know, you can make the world a better place just by doing very simple things. And I just want to thank the listeners too for listening and thanking them in advance for all the good things that they're going to do.
Hell yeah. So that wraps up another episode. And this is kind of the reason why we have the show in the first place, is to bridge the gap between amazing, passionate mycophiles and the listeners that, you know, will take our place one day and to do amazing things with mushrooms and have ourselves be a vehicle for the amazing things that mushrooms have to offer and what we can offer mushrooms as well. So thank you so much. We love you so much. Sending everyone a virtual hug in this time. And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.